And so over the next few years, everyone's got to understand what that skill is and can it help your company in some way and can it help you? I will say I was speaking with a client in my current business and they're looking at AI to help with administrative tasks in HR.
Welcome to Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid. This isn't just a podcast. It's a front row seat to have elite leaders build iconic teams. The kind of leaders who spot potential others overlook, who build cultures people don't want to leave, and who set the bar and then raise it. Whether you're a founder, a hiring manager, or just obsessed with building things the right way, this is your spot. First time here, welcome. Hit that subscribe button, drop a rating, and tell a friend who gets it. To our longtime listeners, appreciate you. Now let's get into it. So today's guest is someone very special. We're joined by Jamie Gabriel. Jamie is a powerhouse in HR leadership who spent over two decades shaping talent strategies for some of the most recognized name in business. She most recently served as the SVP of Talent Strategy and Experience at Altice USA, where she led a 60-person team across talent management, DEI, culture, internal communications, and people experience. Her career has spanned major enterprises like American Express, Northwell Health, and Altice, and where she's turned HR from a back office function into a strategic lever. She's not just a people leader, she's a talent strategist. Jamie, how the heck are you doing today?
I'm great, Oz. Thanks for having me.
Of course. What did you think of that intro?
I mean, I was listening to it going like, oh my goodness, who's saying all this stuff about me?
It sounds awesome. Spotlight on the guests. We love to talk about your experience. We're so grateful for you being here. Got a lot to get into. So we talked a little bit already about, you know, you've had this career that's really kind of spanned HR and you've worked for some really big brands, but I'm always interested to know, how did you first get involved with HR? Like, was it something that you were a young girl kind of hoping and wishing that you could get in HR? Was it something you fell into? Tell us.
Yeah, no, there are no like kindergarten recordings of me saying, hey, I can't wait to be like an HR lady one day. That doesn't exist. I absolutely fell into it. I did what every high school kid does, trying to figure out what you're going to do. Narrowed in on something and thought fashion design was going to be cool and great. And then I did a semester of some textile information and was like, no, never, not for me. I'm not doing this world. And I had some great deans and professors in my college life that kind of moved me around a little bit and helped me find public relations, which is actually what my degree is in, from the University of Florida. And I did some internships while I was down there. And I found that I gravitated towards the nonprofit space when I was pretty young. And public relations and nonprofit is not just PR. It's a end-all, be-all hats to lots of different things. And so I was an office manager. I was in PR. I was in HR. I was doing community. And so that started this interest in how does a company work? How do the pieces come together? And honestly, at the end of the day, that's what I am. I like to see how pieces come together, what kind of pictures you could make out of it. And so I kind of got that bug of not doing just one thing. And I started to meet people in the recruiting space as I was interviewing for the PR job that mom and dad wanted me to go get to prove that my degree was worth something. And those recruiters were like, no, don't do that. You don't want to go be a coffee taker for the first few years. Try this. Try talking to people. Try helping them. And I actually, my first job out of college was as a recruiter for a large recruiting firm. And that's how I started my HR journey.
At Randstad, I set you up there. Yeah. I always love to hear about people, especially when they started their career in recruiting. And that's the way that a lot of people get involved into HR in the first place. And you're right. I don't think I've ever met anybody who was like, yes, I was 8 years old and really hoping that I could work on compensation plans and total rewards. It just happens to be that success is a route that's very rarely very linear. It's a lot of times it takes a lot of curves. So I appreciate you telling us a little bit about that. Also, go Gators down here. I know you're up in the Northeast and I'm down here in South Florida, but Gator chop for all our Florida fans out there. You and I talked a little bit about, so you started in recruiting and then you started to grow into this more broad-based HR career, rising up into leading people for very large organizations, like I mentioned. But you told me about the importance of being a talent strategist, and I'd never really heard that term before. So I'm interested, can you tell me what that means and give me an example of what that might look like and feel like in an organization?
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly that. I started kind of just that inquisitive nature that I described to you I've had since a young age of just figuring out how it comes together. It happened while I was in these generalist roles. And so I started taking on new things in HR. And what I found was there was a common thread through what worked really well and resonated for employees versus what didn't. And if a program or a process was driven in how will your employee engage with this, it worked. But if it was not driven in that, if it was set up by people who want it easier for their job or want it to funnel into a system nicely, and it made more hoops for an employee, it didn't work. And so I started to focus in on why. And this was where kind of my love for the people asset in organizations kind of came from. They are a talent in and of their own way. And each specialty has its own focus, special things they can bring to the table, and ways they can amplify a company. And so if you build your programs with a strategy to help those individuals be able to do their work better, it'll get done. And so I call myself a talent strategist because it doesn't matter how big or small the problem is, program, policy, practice, whatever it is, if your heart of it is how easy is this for an employee to engage?
I really love that. What a fantastic insight on your part, because so many times as leaders, we're thinking about what is the outcome we want, or how do we get this kind of financial cost saving, or how do we improve this customer experience? And yet, if you're not thinking about how the individual that you need to carry this out engages with that, and what their maybe incentive might be, or what they need to do to be able to get good at that, then you're probably just setting yourself up for failure. Another way of saying the change management aspect is just so important to, hey, I want to get X done, but how do I make sure it gets done? It gets done sustainably and consistently, and to make sure that the people who are doing it are engaged in this. I think that is a really brilliant way of looking at it, and a great insight for anybody that's trying to build great process, great outcomes in their organization. Many times when I see these larger organizations, right, HR can become a bit of a box checker, sometimes like a wrist slapper, a little bit more like ones and zeros, black and white than that gray area. You've emphasized the importance of the human in human capital, something that I believe deeply, I'm very passionate about as well. What does it mean to lead an HR organization that is authentic in that approach where with its employee base and where employees can feel that human aspect as part of that function?
It's hard, right? Because at the end of the day, everyone has their own goals, whether it's personal goals, professional goals, or the combination of the two. And sometimes it's just your moment in time and what you have to get done. But to truly be an authentic HR department, you must hold the HR team to a higher standard than the organization. And sorry to anyone who ever worked for me who's listening in now for doing that to them, but I hope they all say that they're better because of it, which is, you know, I had to lead from behind. I can't lead from the front. So we do have lots of conversations. We do have ideation. There is an open forum. It is a bit of a democracy in that team because we need to hear perspective and we need to understand what does this look like at every level in the organization. And I can't remember what that looked like for me. I could barely tell you what I ate yesterday. Never mind remembered 10 years ago how it felt for me to be in an individual contributor role, right? And how are you going to get that perspective is by hearing and hearing from your team. And I went really out of my way to ensure that we built teams of HR folks who were people first. It was about them doing for others, servant leadership, wanting to help. Being in the HR team is not for those who want to be front and center on the main stage. I equate them to being stage managers. If you want to see the show go on beautifully and you're going to do whatever the heck you have to do back there, but no one will ever see you freak out because the stage manager is dressed in black and running everything behind the scenes. That's what makes the HR team authentic. The minute I hire someone in who's not like that, which listen, everybody makes mistakes and I've absolutely done that, it's toxic to the team. And so to make HR truly human first, I needed to make sure that my teams were human first. And then they can then push into the organization in that same way.
I love it. We're going to get back to that hiring aspect in a minute, so hold that thought. You know, one of the things that's a term that we all know very well when you work in human resources is EVP, Employee Value Proposition. And a lot of times when you're trying to attract new talent into your organization, you're trying to convey that EVP. And a lot of what HR's job is to make sure that you're living that employee value proposition. Once they're in your organization, how are you developing them? How are you retaining them? How are you getting them to get engaged with the work like you talked about? What I've always found interesting in that is as you come in a senior level role, right? The organization has an existing EVP, whether they want to or not. Maybe it's clear and conveyed and maybe it's not. But as somebody that's coming to organizations, how have you kind of evaluated what it is currently? And then how have you tried to start shifting it maybe into a more aspirational way or into a more of an evolving way? And then maybe tell us a little bit about some of the mediums and channels that you can use both internally and externally to convey this very important employee value proposition.
Yeah, sure. So I love that you acknowledge that sometimes a value proposition is not intentional. And so the most important thing is when I'm joining any organization, I'm a listen, learn, do person. And by the way, you don't have to be in HR to be a listen, learn, do person. It's 30 days of listening, 30 days of learning, 30 days of doing, and truly committing to that. And you can determine, did the value proposition that the recruiting team had to sell me, and I say that lightly because it's not just recruiting's responsibility, but they take the front of the V very often. Did they sell me what I'm seeing? And if there are gaps between it, what gaps exist? And are they gaps that are good or bad? Because sometimes those gaps don't have to be a bad thing. It's just how we then repackage the communication over time to better align the ships, right? Because at the end of the day, your value proposition is your calling card. It is your modern day card that you leave behind, and people will either see it in the way candidates talk about you online, which you can absolutely not control in any other way other than doing what you can do to try to get them to feel valued. And feel is really important in an employee value proposition. I can't underscore enough how many executive leaders I've sat down and talked to that want to see immediate data and ROI on a value proposition. But it's a feeling, it's a branding, it's an element in which an employee feels connected to your company, and they're going to pick up on it in different ways. So to answer the question of how do you evolve it, once you assess where you are, where the gaps are, you have to test that. I'm only one person, and I think one way. There are thousands of people in some of the companies I've worked at that have come in the last year or touched the company in some way. And so truly listening to how they feel about it, doing listening tours, setting up real engagement surveys, even bringing in people outside of the company, because oftentimes you trust talking to someone you don't know versus talking to someone whose title scares you more than anything else. I don't think I'm a scary person, but my title was definitely scary to some people. Hearing where they see gaps and where they see value and what they thought they were buying is part of that process. And then figuring out what's different. And you should never feel like you have to scrap the whole thing, because that's like throwing out the bathwater with the baby, right? At the same time, no, it's like take a little water out, put a little bit more water in, and let's play with the balance. Because the one thing that many leaders do when they first get to a new place is they make everything before them bad. They ostracize everything before they got there. And the reality is, if you don't assume good intent, you're already setting up your team to not assume good intent. They see that your opinion is that if it's not from under you, it can't be good. And that's just wrong. There are many companies out there who are going to be phenomenally profitable, and I'm never going to work for them. That doesn't mean that they're bad, right? They have great people. And so there's an element of then figuring out how you slightly evolve what you have. If it's really that far off, then yeah, maybe you'll kick off a new campaign. You'll think about a big program push. But at the end of the day, it's going to come back to what I said to you in the beginning. What and how do the employees digest this? Because if your value proposition doesn't give them anything, if it doesn't give them something to connect to or attach to, it doesn't matter. It needs to have something that lives with it. And I will add, even the best value propositions need to be tweaked over time. The world changes around them, and we're living, breathing people that run their companies. And so having the same thing that you had 15 years ago exactly the same way, it's not going to be the same. 15 years ago, you and I were faxing with fax machines, and we didn't even know you can scan stuff through an iPhone. Now we're going to talk about how like our iPhone can figure out what we're thinking before we even get there. It's just things evolve. And so value proposition shouldn't be this big, scary thing that only big companies get. It needs to be something that you're constantly working towards along the way. But yep. I will say it's important. It's a very important
for
thing.
Sure. I mean, and I think you said that brilliantly. There's a couple of things that stand out. First off, the visual of the head of the flying V got me all excited. I'm ready to run through a wall. I love that analogy. And then if I think about what you said about coming in and ostracizing some of the things that had been done previously, right? And saying, just because I'm here and it's new and I was brought in to do something different and that nothing else that came before this is going to make sense for us. Well, then what are you doing to retain the engagement of your team? The people who are probably part of that and probably feel some sort of tie to that at least, right? And so I think it's good to come in and understand maybe what was working, what's not working, and how do we take it? And to your last point, like, can you imagine if you're a company that's trying to hire cutting edge, best in class talent and you're not thinking about technology and you're not thinking about artificial intelligence, you're not thinking about a new way of doing things and a new way of engaging a younger work group and millennials and Gen Z and all these different things? Like, it has to evolve. It has to change. there's certain things that are part of your core values that I would hope would remain with your company throughout time. But otherwise, culture evolves, right? Employee value proposition evolves, and it has to, because things change and dynamics change, needs change. So I think great call out by you. I want to dive a little bit more into hiring, because that happens to be my area of particular obsession. The thing about hiring that's interesting is that, like, everybody thinks they're amazing at it. The data just does not back that up. Even those of us who have done a lot of it and built great teams throughout our career mess up, make mistakes. You brought that up earlier, right? And what do we learn from those teams? So I'm always trying to drive a through line and figure out, you know, the people who have built great teams, what do they see differently? So I want to ask you to start here. If we had to ask about a core hiring philosophy for people that you want to bring into your team, or maybe for the organization at large, what is that? What are you looking at?
Yeah, so I have two different sides of that. From my team standpoint, having led large talent acquisition teams and talent management teams and even business partner teams, my philosophy there is, if you are not buttoned up and ready and you don't know how it's going to feel as a candidate, we don't go to market. Because the more you allow the spin to occur, the less likely we are to find the right person, right? I mean, we all hit that moment. I use the analogy with my teams before. When you're hangry and you go food shopping, you're going to buy things you don't need, right? But if you go and you are full and you got your list and you have a priority, you're in and out of that food store in 20 minutes and you didn't get anything you didn't need. You got everything you wanted, right? So why would we make such an impactful decision on our organization and someone's life? Because the reality is someone is making a personal decision to take a bet on coming to work with us. They don't want to make that bet for it to fail. Innately, they want it to be successful. So why wouldn't we put the time and energy into making it accurate? So that's my philosophy for in-house, right? For when you're there. But for my own team, when I'm hiring people and I want to know, like, hey, we're about to go to market for someone, obviously I need to make sure all those things are in order before we do it. For me, I'm looking for 80%. That's my philosophy. I want you to be able to hit the ground running for at least 80%. And here's why. If you can do more than that, great. I'm not going to turn you down. But your 80% means that there's 20% there that I can give you something to help you grow, might be able to innovate me in something I don't know, because there's a part of you that you've not done the things that I need you to do. I don't want JB Gabriel's replicated everywhere. In fact, I want the complete opposite of me on most of my teams. My direct reports have always brought to the table something I couldn't do. And I value that. So my philosophy has always been about the team balance more than anything else.
I really love that. If I asked you about a memorable interview experience you've had, you don't got to name names, but if there's one that comes to mind, maybe you were interviewing or you were interviewing somebody else, anything come to mind?
I mean, plenty come to mind. I've interviewed many, so I think I'll take more of the vulnerable. I'll tell you about me, because then I don't have to name any names there. Amazing interview I had almost 2 years before I actually took the job. I was speaking with a company when I was at Northwell Health, and I ended up coming to them almost 2 years later to lead a community hospital for them. But I was speaking to them 2 years beforehand for a smaller hospital in their system that was looking for really a number two to kind of groom. And from their job description and my resume lined up, but after we went through the interview process, they were like, it's not. This is kind of too junior for you, and we don't think that this is going to be the right spot. And I was not in a aggressive state that I needed to leave where I was, so I was great and fine. What I loved about it was that it was a very honest interview. Everyone was very clear at the end of each conversation to be like, wow, I think that some of these things we need out of you are probably going to be boring for you, and I'm just going to be honest with you, which I appreciated, because at the end of the day, I'm going to come back to it over and over again. People make bets on their life to go work somewhere because they want it to work out. And so if you can't be honest with them during the interview process and make them understand the good, the bad, and the ugly, then why would they take the bet on you? But what ended up really standing out is we hit it off as people. We got along, our philosophies got along, and we stayed in contact. I'm not talking like a weekly touch base, once a quarter or so. And then there was some leadership changes and they needed some bigger roles. And the minute that happened, I got the phone call. Hey, will you come talk to two more people? Everyone else knows you, loves you. Will you talk to these two others for this specific hospital? And the honesty was still there. Why me? Why the role? What it could look like? Concerns? and ended up doing some amazing work there. So for me, that was a standout one. And meanwhile, it took almost 2 years. So you'd imagine that I would have been a disgruntled candidate, right? But I wasn't, because I was in the know and I agreed with them. I agreed with the feedback they were giving me because it was real and live along the way.
Yeah, a few things stand out there. So one is creating a great candidate experience. I think it's one of the most underrated forms of marketing any organization, particularly any big organization, has, in that when somebody comes to interact with you, they're judging your services, your products, what it's like to work there based on how that interview process goes. If you show up late, if they have no feedback, if you ghost them, it's like all these different situations. It really reflects poorly on the organization. These small things are things that are easier to control. Look at how the experience went with you, where they were being candid and giving you very candid feedback on why they weren't sure it was going to be a fit for you. You appreciated that. And then 2 years later, you ended up coming back and playing a big role in the organization. I'm thinking of two people I have in our organization that have been here 9 and 10 years respectively. And we actually ended up not hiring them initially, but left off on a good spot. And they ended up coming back, and now they've been with our organization for close to a decade in both cases. And you wouldn't have thought that necessarily as the interviews ended. And so keeping that experience, there's no reason not to do that, because you never know how things are going to work out. And I think it's a really, really important thing. So I'm really glad you pointed that. The other thing you said that I really love is people are betting their life on these jobs. And that's, I spent a lot of time, we work a lot with candidates, but we work a lot with companies, obviously, and I'm advocating to them the importance of getting this right, what a great hire can mean versus a good hire versus a bad hire, and what the financial impact of this. But the reality of the situation is it's way more impactful at the individual level. And the company can let somebody go and then rehire and open a job again, right? But if a person makes the wrong job, you know, we've all been there. No one wants to go look on their resume and have a bunch of hopping, right? And so it's like, well, now I got to stay here 2 years to at least prove that I can make it, and I'm in a miserable situation, right? That's tough. And so it's just as important that you are getting an accurate representation and realistic preview of what it's like to work at that company, right? To make sure that you make the right decision. I think the framing of they're betting their life on that, to a degree, that's true, because it really changes everything when you get a new job, your commute, your compensation, your relationships, your growth, you know, the people you meet. Like, it's a big deal. So I'm really with you on that. I think companies need to take that super, super seriously, and the best ones do. So great call out by you. What about a favorite question? Do you have a favorite question you like to ask in interviews?
Yeah, I do. Obviously, there are some that are more like SME driven, but I'm a behavioral question person. I don't really need, especially at a certain level, I don't need you to prove to me that you got the technical chops. I want to know, how introspective are you? How thoughtful are you? Because if you're going to become a leader, or you're joining as a leader, being an empathetic leader is the number one way to ensure that you're thinking about humans first. I love to ask people straight out of the gate, how do you work best? It's a question that could be answered pretty flippantly, like, I get along with everyone, I'm great. And guess what? You're not getting past me on that, because you didn't show any introspection, right? If you ask me that question, you can ask me it on the street, you can ask me it in a suit, I'm going to answer it the same way. I work best when I know someone trusts me. I work best when I work with people that are going to have a natural interest in the project we're working on, and I'm surrounded by them. And I work best when we have a North Star. The North Star doesn't have to be big. It could be something like, we need to get this handbook updated in a week, but at least it's something that when we get to a moment of contention, which we should, because debate leads to really good innovation, that we can then turn to each other and say, well, what is best for our North Star? And so for me, that's how I work best. I can work with different personalities, of course, but there are certain personalities that like to trust each other, and there are certain that do better in having a North Star, and that's how I work best. The reason it matters to me is because it shows that you've reflected, that you've allowed your life experiences to not just be victimized and saying how things were bad in other places, but what could I do better? Where can I be better at this? And that's how I've learned these things about myself, right? Is, oh, that wasn't great for me. It wasn't great because I actually didn't trust the person and they didn't trust me. So that's something I need to figure out, is how I'm going to trust them. And it shows me that there's a maturity to how you're going to approach your role. So I love any behavioral question, but how you work best is my favorite.
That's a great one. And like you said, it's a little bit open-ended. And so people can be really flippant with it, or they can be super introspective. And it's going to tell you a lot about the candidate by the way they handle that. I think it's a good one. I'll write that one down. I'm going to add that to the repertoire.
Finding the right talent for your team doesn't have to be a struggle. Meet Aon Hire, the world's first hiring experience management platform designed to transform the way you hire. Powered by AI, Aon Hire takes the hassle out of every step in the process. From smart resume analysis to customized interview questions, it saves you time, money, and effort. Plus, with real-time insights from every interview, you can quickly identify top candidates, reduce turnover, and stay on budget. And forget about note-taking. Aon Hire takes care of that for you. Ready to revolutionize your hiring process? Visit aonhire.com and get started today.
We talked about candidate experience. We've shared some things. What do you think creates a great candidate experience? What do you like to implement within your structure, your organization to create a great candidate experience?
Absolutely. I think there's lots of things you can do, and there's definitely great ways to make candidates feel more engaged. You can maximize things in your ATSs, things like that. But to me, at the end of the day, a recruiter's relationship with a candidate is the most important part of the experience to me, to the point we were talking about. Timing is everything, and you never know if a great candidate's going to come back later. And that experience comes from not committing to something you can't do. It's okay to not have the answers. Everyone knows the recruiter is not the final decision maker. That's not a secret. But telling me that you're meeting with the client on Thursday and you're going to get back to me on Friday and then I don't hear from you till the following Wednesday, just don't tell me that. Tell me that you're going to catch up and you hope to be back to me in a week's time.
Or how about this? If you do say that and then something happens and a schedule gets moved, how about a nice little note saying, hey, I know I told you it was going to be Thursday. It's got pushed out to next week. I will get back to you. Those simple little things that we do, we make time for what's important that we would want to be treated ourselves, right? And people miss that stuff so often. And it's just the little things that can make such a big difference.
Totally, totally. And I will give a shout out to all of our recruiter friends who are listening in, right? Recload is crazy. We get it. Sometimes you're not in a spot to remember every candidate. We recognize that not every hiring manager trusts their recruiter in the way they should, where they just want to see their top individuals. They might be someone who wants to fish through every resume. I've been there, done that. I don't recommend anyone doing that, by the way, to all those hiring leaders listening. Trust your recruiter and they can help you a lot more. But I get that sometimes there's too much on the plate is really where I'm going. So if you can't remember to do the follow-up because you didn't get it done, then just don't say it. Give honesty to what you're capable of doing, right? There's also this element of feedback. If you can tell someone what's going on, make sure that you're ready to have the conversation. I've seen interactions where it's, oh, just not a good cultural fit, or, oh, we're going in a different direction, or, oh, there was something else there. That's going to frustrate the person because that's not anything tangible. You're better off just saying, I have to be honest with you. We think you're a phenomenal candidate. We're just going in another direction and there's nothing for me to dance with. It is what it is. I might be annoyed with you, but you can bounce back and maybe recruit me again later. But these kind of open-ended, barely there feedback moments, you're leaving the candidate in a position to say, but wait, I do have that. You just didn't ask me about that. Or wait, I can do that. You just don't know that about me. Because oftentimes there is a lot of speed going to the interview process and no one's expecting recruiters to know about my 20 plus year history, right? So you're basing it on what I put in a resume, but my resume can't be 9 pages long either. So it's not going to have every bullet point of everything I'm capable of doing. And so for me, it's don't commit to what you can't do.
And the thing that, I used to recruit, it's been a long time now. I was back in the days with pre-LinkedIn and cold calling into companies and things like that. But when I recruited, I remember the compliment that I got the most was when I would actually call a candidate and say, hey, you didn't get the interview because they didn't feel like you had enough integration experience, or they didn't feel like you were the right fit culturally. Or I would have people stop and then just say, you know what? Thank you so much for telling me that. Because what I really believe is that you're not the perfect fit for every job. That doesn't make you good, bad, or indifferent. It's all fit, right? Just like relationships. And ultimately, when you know why, you can work on that. You can take that and say, that's not something I'm going to change. That's core to who I am, whatever it may be, but you can do something with it. And I know that you don't always get that level of detailed feedback. Hopefully the relationship between recruiting and the management team is good enough where they share. And then you can be savvy enough to articulate that information and that feedback in a way that's going to be helpful with great intent rather than demeaning or hurting somebody or making them feel right. I'm a big believer that there's a good way and a bad way to say pretty much anything. So choosing your words properly, but getting good feedback and being candid about it, I think it's selfish. Otherwise, to be honest, you're more worried about being, making it easy on yourself or well-liked than you are about trying to help the person. I think we'd all be better off if we were trying to help the person, particularly on the recruiting side. All right, here's the go-to question, the money question we talked about a little bit earlier. When you miss on somebody, is there a theme you can look back on, or is there something that you was, I wish I would have done this differently, or maybe something you've learned over your time?
Yeah, there's a few different things. I've learned to ask these behavioral questions, right? I can't tell you in my first few leadership roles that I asked these things. I was more concerned with, Do you have this level of Oracle integration experience? How many trainers have you trained before? What kind of classroom settings do you do in? I've learned that I do better if I trust that my recruiter has done the test of those things. I'm there to figure out the fit for my organization. So behavioral questions has absolutely been something that the misses in my early part of my career have kind of come to. I've also learned that life happens. And so I've had fabulous people that 6 months in, 9 months in, all of a sudden they're showing up different. And most of the time it's something personal going on and something else outside. And a few times it's been not getting the right support in the team. So I think the most important thing is when you have a miss is to not just put your head in the sand on the miss. You actually have to own it and step in front of it and talk to the person. And I've gotten really comfortable with sitting down, taking people to coffee, removing them from the building, having a calming setting to be like, hey, what is going on? This is what I thought we were going to do. And this is what's happening. These are my observations. Help me help you. What do you need? And have the tissues nearby, because this is where I learned about sick parents. And this is where I learned about divorces going on, and where I then learned that the person assigned to be their buddy hasn't been helping them the way they need to. And so making sure that you give every benefit of the doubt in the miss first, I think is something I've learned along the way, because the assumption that what you were sold to what you got is obviously just a farce and wrong is also wrong. Everyone has things going on. I'm a big proponent of your 5 to 9 dictates your 9 to 5. And we have to leave space for people to have those conversations. It's that part of being truly human in a human resources team and authentic. Listen, at the end of the day, could it be? Yeah, of course. But do you think that 100% of your misses are that? Likely not. It's usually something else. And then I see what I can do to help. Sometimes I can help, sometimes I can't. But you know what? In the situations where I can't, I've never had an exit from my team that was brutal. It's always been respectful. It's always been thoughtful. I've never needed security to wait outside of the door, no matter how much my security teams have always wanted to be at the ready, just in case. It's a perk of hiring ex-detectives and things like that. But it's human and it's mature and it's understood and it comes with timelines, because we started having a conversation about the miss and where it was. And I will say a lot of them we've been able to work through, and that's a great thing.
Fantastic answer. Wow. I really appreciate that insight and the empathy and leading with empathy and the benefit of the doubt. I think is such a key thing, such a good thing for leaders to hear. We are contractually obligated to talk about artificial intelligence in all podcasts in 2025. So I want to make sure that we adhere to the standards. Let's start here. Do you have a view on AI and how it's going to impact the workforce over the next 5 to 10 years?
I do. I think it's going to turn into the same technology changes we've seen over the last 10 years, right? It's going to become something that's here to stay. And it's something that will probably have lots of fanfare in the upcoming years. And then it'll die off and just become part of your everyday. What I think is important is I think you as an individual need to educate yourself on what it is and isn't for your job, because it is relevant to certain jobs in certain ways and not to others. And so it's a scary term because it's marketed that way sometimes, but it's also an innovative term depending on which things you're reading, right? So I think the most important is it's a new skill. And so over the next few years, everyone's got to understand what that skill is. And can it help your company in some way? And can it help you? I will say I was speaking with a client in my current business, and they're looking at AI to help with administrative tasks in HR. The element of it sounds interesting to me. I don't know any employee relations manager that would say, no, I want to continue to take my notes, rewrite my notes, and look for themes myself if someone can generate that for me. It's not saying it's taking the place of employee relations. It's saying it's helping those ER managers be able to have more eye-to-eye contact conversations instead of being behind their desk, typing things up, preparing documents, and then using the system to inevitably look and see patterns. I have tons of follow-up questions, of course, and I'm going to continue to work with them as a client to make sure that it meets all the other HR things that we have concerns with. But to me, it's something that's going to just be here to stay, and we have to learn to work with it. It's not going to fully replace.
Yeah, I love that way you said it is a skill. And what it really does is it's going to up-level the type of work that you're doing, right? The role and responsibilities tend to probably stay somewhat similar, but the type of work that you're doing, where you're spending your time, how productive you're being in that time, right, is going to be very different. For instance, there was a day where we had filing cabinets, right? We used to do that. And then if you had to search for it, you'd have to go through. And now we move to Microsoft Word and Excel and different operating systems. And now we have all different types of search functionality. So what is AI going to be able to take off of our place so we can spend our time on that higher value work, that work that we couldn't get to, the work that we've always wanted to do, the work that hopefully is more challenging and more purposeful, right? Because employee relations is not about just automating with AI. There's some things, obviously, like you said, like catching themes and note-taking and things like that, that AI can help with. But employee relations is about human interaction and understanding the other person and what's going there. And that's not something that technology is going to replace. So I think that's a really good call out. What about particularly, I mean, you mentioned a little bit in HR. Do you have any other strong opinions on where are going to be the first use cases in HR for AI?
Yeah, I think in HR, employee relations is a pretty easy focus because of how much different note-taking happens, right? And there's unnecessary biases in ER for no other reason than you have so many human personalities going on. So I think it's a great place to put it into. I do think AI can take over some of the employee engagement listening tour type things, whether it's really just listening while someone like myself is talking to a group, or if it's allowing employees to communicate into surveys and getting data quickly. Really, that analytical aspect of HR is probably a place that you can see some of this happening, especially when you think about what tools employees touch today. Many companies have an intranet, they have a Slack or some sort of instant messenger tool that will allow AI to be able to pick up themes and the energy of what's going on in the organization. Obviously, you can see the dark side of where that could go. And so you need to make sure that you have a very smartly skilled HR department who understands the limitations of the system and where they're going to step in, right? And be able to then transparently talk to your employees. I think like anything else, whatever you're doing, if you don't journey message to your employees what's happening, it's innately bad, no matter what.
Great. You have your own consulting business now. Are you using AI in any way in your day-to-day? Can you give us a little insight into that?
Yeah. So I played with it a little bit more just so that I know. And I've taken a few different skills training classes. I will say super easy is like a LinkedIn learning on AI, but everyone feels like they know what AI is, similar to everyone feels like they can recruit. So you can go on YouTube and find tons of content. But you know what I've done? I've used things where I've written something and then I said, hey, is this positioned correctly for the algorithm that is LinkedIn? Or is this positioned correctly for an algorithm that I want to drive interaction with others on? And AI has actually given me feedback on it. Like, no, actually, you're using too many words, or visuals are actually really something that's really working right now on LinkedIn. Remove hashtags for this because it's not something that individuals are gravitating towards. So I've used it almost as like, I'm going to say like an intern to talk to, right? Because I'm just me right now as an individual consultant, which I'm absolutely loving, that kind of freedom of the leadership portion not being there and being able to drive work. But sometimes the dog doesn't answer when I say stuff out loud. So I've tried it with AI and I will say it's been helpful. There are downsides to it, right? I've also done my own research on like, how can you tell when something's ChatGPT written? And I know that I don't talk in hyphens, so my writing shouldn't be with hyphens. I did have one bummer moment. If you do ask ChatGPT to write a note for you, it always writes best as the signature. And it's so frustrating for me because I've been writing best since like 2000.
You're
and now
have to move to Cheers or like Yours Truly or something.
I'm going to have to change my closing just because people are going to think my writing isn't me. Though I've always been an authentic writer. When you read an email from me or a communication, it sounds like I'm speaking to you. I frustrated a lot of communications teams by doing that.
So you are. That's how you be an authentic communicator and leader. ChatGPT must have stole that for you. They obviously picked what was the best way to close out an email and realized that Jamie Gabriel is doing this. We better go that route. All right, let's take it out of the artificial intelligence technology world. Let's go back to good old-fashioned books. Have you got any bit of content, whether it's a book or even if it's something that you've seen on TV or a podcast, like recommend something for our listeners that you really enjoy?
Yeah. I've reread for the second time a book called Recalculating, and it's by Lindsay Pollack. Lindsay is someone that I've brought into a few organizations to speak. So I can say that she's become a friend over time. She focuses in on generational differences and how you have to lead differently for different generations and how you can make multi-generations work in the workplace. But she wrote Recalculating kind of right after the pandemic moment, and it resonated with many, especially in the organization I was in at the time, because we were trying to figure out how we're going to move forward. And so the idea of when you're driving in a car and there's traffic on the parkway and you get off and all of a sudden your GPS is recalculating, how do you do that with your life? How do you recalculate in a different way? So obviously I took a big jump, a big bet on myself that I didn't want to do the corporate thing anymore and I wanted to strike out. And a lot of it's aligned to the things that matter to me most. And so I reread her book on recalculating because it felt like it was a really good alignment. So I will say that that's my recommendation right now, especially if you're thinking about doing something different, whether it's personal or professional. It's always nice to feel like you have a voice in your head. And Lindsay writes in that way. She's not using like big business terms. She's not using things that you need a dictionary next to you for. She's talking to you like a friend and she's helping you think through how to do something different.
I like that. I'm going to check that one out. Okay, last question before our lightning round. If you had to offer some advice to your 20-year-old self that you didn't know then, but that you know now, what would that advice be?
Oh my gosh, I have so much advice. We'll stick to the professional advice for now. But the biggest thing for me as of lately is take the bet on yourself. Prioritize yourself. So often did I say, you know what, I'm going to turn down that speaking engagement, or I'm not going to go to that conference because work needs me. Work needs this out of me. I need to focus on this at work, or, you know, I'm going to miss out on these things. And what I'm finding as I'm getting older is, wow, why did I do that? Why didn't I find the space to go? Why did I turn down being part of that moment? Doing things for you is the only thing in the briefcase you can take with you. Everything else is for your organization. And so at the end of the day, you're only going to be better for wherever you go next if you fill that briefcase with more things. So I think a younger me needs to be told, it's okay. You'll figure it out. There's more hours in the day tomorrow. Go do something that works for you.
What great advice. Hopefully there's somebody listening to that needed to hear that, taking a bet on yourself. Very important. Good stuff, Jamie. All right, we're going to go to our lightning round. You know some of these questions, but you don't know most of them. We're going to start here. For you personally, define the perfect schedule, hybrid, remote, on-site, 5 days a week. What does it look like for you and your team?
Yeah, perfect schedule for me is fully remote. Been doing it for a long, long time, way before it was cool, because I supported Pack Asia back in my early days.
What are some of your tips then managing remotely? Because it can be a little bit more difficult to check in, to get a feel for people. You're missing out on body language. You're missing out on some of that osmosis. What are some of the tips that you had to be kind of more intentional as a manager and leader doing things fully remote?
Yeah. Listen, what you can't see is on the left side of the desk is a open loose leaf every day that is with the specific emotional follow-ups I need to do. Someone said something in a conversation and I want to send a text the next day to make sure that they're okay. Someone told me that their child's graduating. I want to make sure I check in on Saturday. How do I build those relationships that aren't being done at the water cooler? Because honestly, a lot of the in-person is that kind of relationship building, seeing things, feeling things. So I do have that element of how do I keep myself in touch with people. I've also learned to just ask more direct, intentional questions. There's not a lot of dancing around when you're remote. Asking very soft-footed questions that you're then going to look around the boardroom and see how their reactions are, that can happen in person. But when you're remote, you have to be able to say openly, I disagree with this. And I need to understand why we're doing this, and not say it in a timid way, because there is no interpretation elements. There's no, is she fidgeting? Is she moving? Is she walking around? I've also learned that being remote means that I need to be very open with how others want to communicate with me. So sometimes it's a phone call, because they need to be in a special private place where if we were on site together, we would maybe go walk and have some coffee or something of that nature. So I've had to be more open with it. What I love about being remote is that I don't have a lot of what I call the drive-by. A lot of my life in certain jobs was wasted every day by drive-by. People who want to just drop by with a, I just wanted you to know, which is really a, no, you're staging this for something and you're just not being honest with me that you're staging this for something and you want me to go do your work, which is totally fine. Sometimes it's appropriate, sometimes it's not. But it messed with my ability to get work done, right? Which is to be able to sit down, focus, be creative, and really listen. I'm very much a active listener. And so being remote allows for no one to distract me while I'm listening to someone talk.
Love that. Okay. Percentage of meetings in your corporate America experience that are productive versus complete time wastes?
I'm going to say almost all of them are complete time wastes. The reality is I'm a firm believer in this could have been an email. But again, I'm an active listener, so I'm also an active reader. You can't send me something and I'm going to be like, oh, yeah, I saw it and I didn't see it. No, I usually read it, printed it, and provided you feedback because that's how I believe I should support it. So I do think meetings have a time and place if there's a clear agenda, we have the right stakeholders in the room, and there's focused time. But in many organizations, that happens too often and too much that you then schedule these huge offsites to try to get the work done. But as soon as you turn something into an offsite, you've already removed the ability to get work done because the element of an offsite feels like there's going to be other elements of team building and celebration tied to it. You're not just going to go sit in a room. And plus, the fatigue of sitting in a room to do that many hours of meetings won't get done either. So for me, a lot of it's wasted.
It could have been an email. All right. Favorite Gator of all time?
Mine's going to be Chris Leak. Not really a high priority one, but here's why. He was in college when I was in college.
Listen, I remember Chris Leak well. He was the one that Team Tebow took over for. Yeah. And there was a little bit of chomping at the bit. No pun intended. Sure. Maybe have Tebow take over for him earlier.
Exactly. He came back and coached for the Gators for a little bit, too. But we had come off of some really hard years. And he was the beginning step of what then became the Tebow legacy. And I think call it a bit of the HR empathetic leader in me, but I think everyone in teams has an important play. And just because he wasn't the big celebrity doesn't mean he wasn't very important.
I remember Chris Leak well. Beautiful eyes. I think he had blue eyes,
yeah,
if I remember correctly.
Yeah, blue eyes. I still have my Chris Leak jersey somewhere in this house.
I love that. All right. Favorite guilty pleasure?
Ooh, it's going to be ice cream with my kids.
Ice cream with your kids. What's your favorite go-to flavor?
Coffee.
Coffee ice cream.
Yeah.
Are you giving that to the kids, though? Are they getting wired if they have coffee ice cream?
Interestingly enough, my 9-year-old loves to have coffee ice cream in a cone, but she's also 9 going on like 32 and probably knows her martini order. She's firstborn and all the energy is accurate. The middle one, who's 7, she'll pick anything that's got the most food coloring in it. And then the little guy, who will be 5 in a few months, is vanilla all the way.
Vanilla all the way. Last question.
Yeah.
Then who is your spirit animal?
I don't know if I would say I have a specific spirit animal in an actual animal, but I will say that because the little guy who I just mentioned, he's around a lot. We are watching a lot of Mickey Mouse Clubhouse. So if I can kind of tweak it in spirit animal to be animal-esque, I'm going to say I think it's Daisy Duck.
Oh, okay. Tell us why Daisy.
Yeah. So Daisy, first of all, she's a ride or die friend. She's amazing. She is like at the side of Donald, no matter how silly he's being. She's always there to help Minnie with her bow shop. And she's always got a positive attitude. And she's constantly ready to just jump in and lend a hand, but also down for the adventure. She's going to go into the jungle with Goofy whenever she needs to. So for me right now, it's Daisy.
That's the best breakdown of Daisy Duck I've ever heard. hot dog, hot diggity dog. Jamie, I really appreciate you spending a little time with me. Thanks for coming on the show. I can't wait to keep the conversation going. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, talk to you later.